natural events had reached the critical point. The station, affected by Hurricane Sandy and very severe financial problems, seemed to be going under. We almost lost our beloved station. I became a volunteer, making and answering phone calls, helping with mailing, and delivering premiums. I became an active member of the Community Advisory Board, CAB. I met other volunteers and CAB members, almost all identified with the Indy Caucus. I don't think I ever met any member of JUC helping. I was asked to run as a candidate for the LSB. I thought that my extensive experience with cooperative organizations and businesses might be helpful in trying to keep WBAI going. To save WBAI, please support me and other Indy candidates.
Hello, all in the BAI family. My name is Mario Mastandrea. I'm running again for the LSB at WBAI 99.5 FM. Vote for me, and I will work to improve what we have left at WBAI. Help to raise funds is one of my goals for the station and for the network. We have good people here at the station. Let's stay on the air. My email is mariomadeit@gmail.com. That's mariomadeit@gmail.com. Please vote for me. Thank you.
I'm Maura Meltzer-Cohen with Justice and Unity, endorsed by Lynn Stewart, the Free Mumia Coalition, and others. In my work in community legal education, my success requires the humility to subsume my own interests to a larger mission. As an attorney supporting people's liberation movements, my success depends upon listening to conflicting needs and mediating creative solutions. I and the communities in which I live and work rely on WBAI for accurate reporting and critical analysis. I look forward to helping the station better serve the communities that need it most by exploring innovations in FM technology. Please support our entire slate. For more info, go to justiceunity.org.
For more information on the election, visit elections.pacifica.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Frank from Spearhead.
And this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial peace and justice radio in New York.
People moving out, people moving in. Why? Because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 put your shoulder high. Yeah, yeah.
Let me hear you, let me hear you.
Thank you. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, and I am joined in studio by my cohort,
Matt Mazza.
What is the number on your microphone? Let's try that again. Say your name again. It's okay.
Four.
Okay, go ahead.
Matt Mazza.
Oh, yeah, I got you. Yes, so we're going to be doing a little bit more of our reading on Ishmael today. And we did anticipate an interview with Mazatzin, and he was going to tell us about some various special events coming up in the next week. But apparently, he is not available at this time. So I'm just going to share a little bit with you, for those of you who are interested in hearing about it. Yui Tlotakan Grand Council, 10 plus 1 Sacred Circle of Grandmothers and Grandfathers, Sages of the Planet. They're having a press conference, Re-Encounter of Indigenous People of the Eagle with the People of the Condor in Concordance, Fulfilling the Promise. We respectfully invite all public means of communication, newspaper, press, radio, television, internet, and the general public to our press conference, where we'll present the upcoming gathering of the 10 plus 1 Sacred Circle of Grandmothers and Grandfathers, Sages of the Planet, coming to the United Nations from 9 countries, Peru, Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, and Guatemala, Mexico plus 1 Circle in Spain. And this press conference, this event, is going to be on Thursday, September 15th at 7 p.m. This is in Queens at Salinas Corona Restaurant, 102-2 Northern Boulevard. That's Corona, Queens, 11368. And for information, you can call 646-463-0506 and find out more about the series of events that will be taking place in the next week. And it's an event co-sponsored by the United Nations Women's Guild, UNWG, and Cabriety Inc., a non-governmental organization in special consultation status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council since 2012. And further down this release, it says, the Western Hemisphere is one that all its inhabitants lived in accordance with the natural laws, primary of which are respecting each other and all that surrounds one, and recognizing everything and everybody as a precious twin, a cosmos perception of being an individual and cosmos at the same time. One continent, one culture, with a multitude of languages, customs, and traditions, with communication and relations of national and international dimensions. The contributions of the original First Nations peoples are immeasurable, and their wisdom in science and astronomy and the right relationship between human beings and their environment is still taken into account, that even today is in the crosshairs of the search for purpose by both the young and the old. So this is a bringing forth of the wisdom of the indigenous people, of the eagle with the people of the condor. The condor are the people in South America. The eagle are the people of North America. And there's a series of events coming up. I don't have all the information, unfortunately, because my guest, I think, was a little bit undone by the hour, and for reasons that seem quite reasonable, I haven't been able to get in touch. So hopefully we'll get this information for you before the events commence. And that will be next week on the 14th, which is a Wednesday. But there's a series of events that go on throughout the month of September. So hopefully we'll be able to get that to you while you have an opportunity to gather more information and participate in this coming together of these elders and wisdom keepers. If you'd like more information as I receive it, I can send it to you by email. You can reach out to me at heartofmindradio@gmail.com. That's heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And while I'm making announcements before we get to our reading, I'll remind you that I have two Qigong sessions left, meditation sessions that will be taking place in the Bronx. So for those of you who would like to enjoy and join me for that, they are free. It will be this coming Saturday, the 17th of September, in St. James Park. I'll be teaching from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. And then Chef Wilson will be offering healthy eating tips. And she always has something tasty for everyone to have as a snack. And then at 11:30 a.m., Nanamdi Nelson will offer some light physical fitness. And that's at St. James Park, 2550 Jerome Avenue. And that's between 193rd Street and Creston Avenue in the Bronx. You can take the 4 train to Fordham Road, Jerome Avenue, or to Kingsbridge Road and Jerome Avenue for that Saturday free class. The following week, September 24th, we'll be at Seton Falls Park, the same lineup, 10 a.m. starting with Qigong. And then we have healthy eating and physical fitness for those who want to stay for that. And Seton Falls Park is a little bit further uptown, East 233rd Street between Seton and Baychester Avenue in the Bronx. You would take the 5 train to East Chester Dyer Avenue, and you'd be able to walk to the park from that train station. Or you could take the Bronx, the BX16 bus to that. So that being shared, let's move on to our reading of Ishmael with Matt. How do you say your last name? Meza?
Mazza.
Mazza. All this time I've been pronouncing your name wrong. How many years have I known you?
Well, you know, I'm Greek, but the M-A-Z-Z-A, it's a very common Italian name, and they would pronounce it Mazza.
Okay.
Not to be confused with that bread, that unleavened bread that the Jewish people use in Passover.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, proceed.
Anyway, so, we left off.
Move in closer to the mic or move it closer to you.
We.
So people can hear
clearly. All right. So, we left off. I think we are in Division 3, Chapter 3, Subsection 4, we left off. And Ishmael was trying to teach his students the fundamental creative processes of the universe came to a halt 5 billion years ago when our solar system made its appearance. That would offer at least some support for these notions. So, Ishmael is questioning him. So, what are we to make of that story you told? It's a myth. He gets his student to see that we're living a myth, basically, according to this dialogue. And we are now on Subsection 5. I told you yesterday that the story the people of your culture are enacting is about the meaning of the world, about divine intentions in the world, and about human destiny. Yes. And according to this first part of the story, what is the meaning of the world? I thought about that for a moment. I don't quite see how it explains the meaning of the world. Along about the middle of your story, the focus of attention shifted from the universe at large to this one planet. Why? Because this one planet was destined to be the birthplace of man. Of course, as you tell it, the birth of man was a central event, indeed the central event in the history of the cosmos itself. From the birth of man on, the rest of the universe ceases to be of interest, ceases to participate in the unfolding drama. For this, the earth alone is sufficient. It is the birthplace and home of man, and that's its meaning. The takers regard the world as a sort of human life support system, as a machine designed to produce and sustain human life. Yes, that's so. Now remember the takers and the leavers. The takers are like the hunter-gatherers, and later on the takers are the agriculturists. They came later on, and the leavers are the hunter-gatherers. So, in your telling of the story, you naturally left out any mention of the gods because you didn't want it to be tainted with mythology. Since its mythological character is now established, you no longer have to worry about that. Supposing there is a divine agency behind creation, that what can you tell me about the gods' intentions? Well, basically, they had in mind when they started out was man. They made the universe so that our galaxy could be in it. They made the galaxy so that our solar system could be in it. They made our solar system so that our planet could be in it. They made the planet so that we could be in it. The whole thing was made so that man would have a hunk of dirt to stand on. And this is generally how it's understood in your culture, at least by those who assume that the universe is an expression of divine intention. Yes. Obviously, since the entire universe was made so that man could be made, man must be a creature of enormous importance to the gods. But this part of the story gives no hint of their intentions toward him. They must have some special destiny in mind for him, but that's not revealed here. True. Every story is based on a premise, is the working out of a premise. As a writer, I'm sure you know that. Yes. You'll recognize this one. Two children of warring families fall in love. Right. Romeo and Juliet. The story being enacted in the world by the takers also has a premise, which is embodied in the part of the story you told me today. See if you can figure out what it is. I closed my eyes and pretended I was working hard, when in fact, I knew I didn't stand a chance. I'm afraid I don't see it. The story the Leavers have enacted in the world has an entirely different premise, and it would be impossible for you to discover it at this point. But you should be able to discover the premise of your own story. It's a very simple notion, and that most powerful in all of human history. Not necessarily the most beneficial, but certainly the most powerful. Your entire history, with all its marvels and catastrophes, is a working out of this premise. Truthfully, I can't even imagine what you're getting at. Think. Look, the world wasn't made for jellyfish, was it? No. It wasn't made for frogs or lizards or rabbits. No. Of course not. The world was made for man. That's right. Everyone in your culture knows that, don't they? Even atheists who swear there is no God know that the world was made for man. Yes, I'd say so. All right. That's the premise of your story. The world was made for man. I can't quite grasp it. I mean, I can't quite see why it's a premise. The people of your culture made it a premise, took it as a premise. They said, what if the world was made for us? Okay, keep going. Think of the consequences of taking that as your premise. If the world was made for you, then what? Okay, I see what you mean. I think. If the world was made for us, then it belongs to us, and we can do what we damn well please with it. Exactly. Kind of a little bit of like Israel and Palestine, isn't it? Exactly. That's what's been happening here for the past 10,000 years. You've been doing what you damn well please with the world. And of course, you mean to go right on doing what you damn well please with it, because the whole thing belongs to you. Sort of like a celestial law of eminent domain. Yes, I said, and thought for a second. Actually, that's pretty amazing. I mean, you hear this 50 times a day. People talk about our environment, our seas, our solar system. I've even heard people talk about our wildlife. And just yesterday, you assured me with complete confidence that there was nothing in your culture remotely resembling mythology. True, I did. Ishmael continued to stare at me morosely. I was wrong, I told him. What more do you want? Astonishment, he said. I nodded. I'm astonished, all right. I just don't let it show. I should have gotten you when you were 17. I shrugged, meaning that I wished he had. Subsection 7. Yesterday, I told you that your story provides you with an explanation of how things came to be this way. Right. What contribution does this first part of the story make to that explanation? You mean, what contribution does it make to explain how things came to be the way they are right now? That's right. Offhand, I don't see how it makes any contribution to it. Think. Would things have come to be this way if the world had been made for jellyfish? No, they wouldn't. Obviously not. If the world had been made for jellyfish, things would be entirely different. That's right. But it wasn't made for jellyfish. It was made for man. And this partly explains how things came to be this way. Right. It's sort of a sneaky way of blaming everything on the gods. If they'd made the world for jellyfish, then none of this would have happened. Exactly, Ishmael said. You're beginning to get the idea. Subsection 8. Do you have a feeling now for where you might find the other parts of this story, the middle and the end? I gave this some thought. I'd watch Nova, I think. Why? I'd say that if Nova was doing the story of creation, the story I told today would be an outline. All I have to do now is figure out how they do the rest. Then that's your next assignment. Tomorrow I want to hear the middle of the story. End of subsection 8. We're now into chapter 4. Chapter 4, subsection 1. Okay, I said. I think I have the middle and the end of the story down pat. Ishmael nodded, and I started the tape recorder. What I did was start with a premise. The world was made for man. Then I asked myself, how would I write the story as a treatment for Nova? It came out like this. The world was made for man, but it took him a long, long time to figure that out. For nearly 3 million years, he lived as though the world had been made for jellyfish. That is, he lived as though he were just like any other creature, as though he were a lion or a wombat. What exactly does it mean to live like a lion or a wombat? It means to live at the mercy of the world. It means to live without having any control over your environment. I see. Go on. Okay. In this condition, man could not be truly man. He couldn't develop a truly human way of life, a way of life that was distinctly human. So during the early part of his life, actually the greater part of his life, man just foozled along, getting nowhere and doing nothing. As it happened, there was a key problem to be solved, and it was this that took me a long time to work out. What the problem was, man could get nowhere living like a lion or a wombat. Because if you're a lion or a wombat, in order to accomplish anything, man had to settle down in one place where he could get to work, so to speak. I mean that it was impossible for him to get beyond a certain point living out in the open as a hunter-gatherer, always moving from place to place in search of food. To get beyond that point, he had to settle down, had to have a permanent base from which he could begin to master his environment. Okay, why not? I mean, well, what was stopping him from doing that? What was stopping him was the fact that if he settled down in one place for more than a few weeks, he'd starve. As a hunter-gatherer, he would simply clean the place out. There would be nothing left to hunt and gather. In order to achieve settlement, man had to learn one fundamental manipulation. He had to learn how to manipulate his environment so that his food exhaustion didn't occur. He had to manipulate it so that it produced more human food. In other words, he had to become an agriculturist. This was the turning point. The world had been made for man, but he was unable to take possession of it until this problem was cracked. And he finally cracked it about 10,000 years ago, back there in the Fertile Crescent. This was a very big moment, the biggest in human history up to this point. Man was at last free of all these restraints that the limitations of the hunter-gathering life had kept man in check for 3 million years. With agriculture, those limitations vanished, and his rise was meteoric. Settlement gave rise to division of labor. Division of labor gave rise to technology. With the rise of technology came trade and commerce. With trade and commerce came mathematics and literacy and science and all the rest. The whole thing was underway at last, and the rest, as they say, is history. And that's the middle of the story. Subsection 2. Very impressive, Ishmael said. I'm sure you realize that the big moment you've just described was, in fact, the birth of your culture. Yes. It should be pointed out, however, that the notion that agriculture spread across the world from a single point of origin is distinctly old hat. Nevertheless, the Fertile Crescent remains the legendary birthplace of agriculture, at least in the West, and this has a special importance that we'll look at later on. Okay. Yesterday's part of the story revealed the meaning of the world as it's understood among the takers. The world is a human life support system, a machine designed to produce and sustain human life. Right. today's part of the story seems to be about the destiny of man. Obviously, it was not man's destiny to live like a lion or a wombat. That's right. What is man's destiny then? I said. Well, man's destiny is to accomplish great things. As it's known among the takers, man's destiny is more specific than that. Well, I suppose you could say that his destiny is to build civilization. Think mythologically. I'm afraid I don't know how that's done. I'll demonstrate. Listen. I listened. Subsection 3. As we saw yesterday, creation wasn't complete when jellyfish appeared, or when amphibians appeared, or when reptiles appeared, or even when mammals appeared. According to your mythology, it was complete only when man appeared. Right. Why was the world and the universe incomplete without man? Why did the world and the universe need man? I don't know. Well, think about it. Think about the world without man. Imagine the world without man. Okay, I said, and closed my eyes. A couple of minutes later, I told him I was imagining the world without man. What's it like? I don't know. It's just the world. Where are you? What do you mean? Where are you looking at it from? Oh, from above, from outer space. What are you doing up there? I don't know. Why aren't you down on the surface? I don't know. Without man on it, I'm just a visitor, an alien. Well, go down from the surface. Okay, I said, but after a minute, I went on to say, that's interesting. I'd rather not go down there. Why? What's down there? The jungle is down there. I see you mean nature, red in tooth and claw, dragon of the prime that tear each other in their slime. That's it. And what would happen if you did go down there? I'd be the ones the dragons were tearing in their slime. I opened my eyes in time to see Ishmael nodding. And it is at this point that we begin to see where man fits into the divine scheme. The gods didn't mean to leave the world a jungle, did they? You mean in our mythology? Certainly not. So, without man, the world was unfinished, was just a nature, red in tooth and claw. It was in chaos, in a state of primal anarchy. That's right, that's it, exactly. So it needed what? It needed someone to come in and straighten it out. Someone to put it in order. And what sort of person is it who straightens things out? What sort of person takes anarchy in hand and puts it in order? Well, a ruler, a king. Of course, the world needed a ruler. It needed man. Yes. So now we have a clearer idea of what the story is all about. The world was made for man, and man was made to rule it. Yes, that's very obvious now. Everyone understands that. And this is what? What? Is this fact? No. Then what is it? It's mythology, I said, of which no trace is to be found in your culture. That's right. Once again, Ishmael stared at me glumly through the glass. Look, I said after a bit, the things you're showing me, the things you're doing are almost beyond belief. I know that, but it's just not in me to leap up out of my chair while striking my brow and crying, "My God, this is incredible!" He wrinkled his forehead thoughtfully for a moment before saying, "What's wrong with you, then?" He seemed so genuinely concerned that I had to smile, all frozen inside. I told him an iceberg. He shook his head, sorry for me. To return to our subject, as you say, it took man a long time to tumble to the fact that he was meant for greater things than he could achieve living like a lion or a wombat. For some 3 million years, he was just part of the anarchy, was just one more creature rolling around in the slime. Right. It was only about 10,000 years ago that he finally realized that his place was not in the slime. He had to lift himself out of the slime and take this place in hand and straighten it out. Right. But the world didn't meekly submit to human rule, did it? No. No, the world defied him. What man built up, the wind and rain tore down. The fields he cleared for his crops and his villages, the jungle fought to reclaim. The seeds he sowed, the birds snatched away. The shoots he nurtured, the insects nibbled. The harvest he stored, the mice plundered. The insects nibbled, the harvest he stored, and the animals he bred, fed, the wolves and foxes stole away. The mountains, the rivers, and the oceans stood in their places and would not make way for him. The earthquake, the flood, the hurricane, the blizzard, and the drought would not disappear at his command. True. The world would not meekly submit to man's rule, so he had to do what to it? What do you mean? If the king comes to a city that will not submit to his rule, what does he have to do? He has to conquer it. Of course. In order to make himself the ruler of the world, man first had to conquer it. Good Lord, I said, and nearly leaped up out of my chair while striking my brow and all the rest. Yes? You hear this 50 times a day. You can turn on the radio or the television and hear it every hour. Man is conquering the deserts. Man is conquering the oceans. Man is conquering the atom. Man is conquering the elements. Man is conquering outer space. Ishmael smiled. You didn't believe me when I said that this story is ambient in your culture. Now you see what I mean. The mythology of your culture hums in your ears so constantly that no one pays the slightest bit of attention to it. Of course man is conquering space and the atom and the deserts and the oceans and the elements. According to your mythology, this is what he was meant to do, what he was born to do. Yes, it's very clear now. Subsection 5. Now, the first two parts of the story have come together. The world was made for man, and man was made to conquer and rule it. And how does the second part contribute to your explanation of how things came to be this way? Let me think about that. Once again, this is a sort of a sneaky way of blaming the gods. They made the world for man, and they made man to conquer and rule it, which he eventually did. And this is how things came to be the way they are. Nail it down. Go a little deeper. I closed my eyes and gave it a couple of minutes, but nothing came. Ishmael nodded toward the windows. All this, all your triumphs and tragedies, all your marvels and miseries, are a direct result of what? I chewed on it for a while, but I still couldn't see what he was getting at. Try it this way, Ishmael said. Things wouldn't be the way they are if the gods had meant man to live like a lion or a wombat, would they? No. Man's destiny was to conquer and rule the world. So things came to be this way as a direct result of man fulfilling his destiny. Of course. And he had to fulfill his destiny, didn't he? Yes, absolutely. So what is there to get excited about? Very true, very true. As the takers see it, all this is simply the price of becoming human. How do you mean? It wasn't possible to become fully human living beside the dragons and the slime, was it? No. In order to become fully human, man had to pull himself out of the slime. And all this is the result. As the takers see it, the gods gave man the same choice they gave Achilles. A brief life of glory, or a long, uneventful life in obscurity. And the takers chose a brief life of glory. Yes, that's certainly how it's understood. People just shrug and say, well, this is the price that had to be paid for indoor plumbing and central heating and air conditioning and automobiles and all the rest. I gave him a quizzical look. And what are you saying? I'm saying that the price you paid is one. The price you paid is not the price of becoming human. It's not even the price of having the things you just mentioned. It's the price of enacting a story that casts mankind as the enemy of the world. End of chapter 4.
Mankind as enemy of the world. Well, that actually sounds like the world that I've been living in. So what do you think of this, Matt? What does it say to you?
Well, look at how we conquered the universe. Yes, we conquer it, but at what price? We conquer it, but at the same time we're polluting our water supplies, poisoning our air and our land. And we're causing diseases, new diseases, wholesale, big time.
Mm-hmm.
So people call this progress. As long as they can go home to drink clean water and bathe in Scarsdale, well, if the indigenous peoples have it, well, it's sacrifice. So certainly so. It certainly makes sense.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. That's the world we're living in. And it's interesting how in the book they're describing the, what is it, the feeders? And what was the other group?
The leavers and the takers.
The leavers and the takers. Somehow that fit, that read into feeders for me, the leavers and the takers. So, which are you?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I would have to think about that. Because I'm thinking I might be a consolidation of the two. I certainly eat agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, we do hunting, gathering in a different way now. Yes. So it might be a consolidation. Now we kind of hunt for energy. It's a new kind of thing to hunt.
I don't think it's so new, but, yeah, I just think that the what we recognize as energy, because energy is food.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about the energy.
About fuel?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We do that. And you know, you could call it psychic energy. We're looking for that, too. Mm-hmm. Spiritual energy. I guess we're supposed to be able to create it. But you know, we have to learn how to do that. So I guess, you know, it's we're kind of a melding. It's kind of like a melding of the two.
Mm-hmm.
We do hunt and gather a certain amount. And we also take. We're taking agriculture. You know, we're growing things. And I guess it would be okay if we did it in balance. Like if you wanted to chop down some trees and make furniture from the rainforest, if you did a little bit of it, and then you left it alone for a while, it would grow back.
Mm-hmm.
But we want to do it more and more and more. We want to increase profits. So we chop down huge sections, and it can't sustain itself. If you go to the Central Park Zoo, they have an actual rainforest. You can walk in there. It's a beautiful exhibit. And they have a plaque. Rainforest, I think the size of New York State, is being destroyed every day. You know, can you imagine the size of New York State? New York State is big. That's a big section of rainforest to cut down every day. This is a statistic that they give.
That's pretty frightening. I traveled into the rainforest some years ago in Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. I traveled to Ecuador in order to visit a rainforest because I got into my mind that I would really like to see them before they're gone. And it was during a time when I was doing training for the New York City Marathon, and one of the people I got to know in that process was from Ecuador. So he arranged for some of us to go down and actually stay with his family, who lived in Riobamba. And Riobamba was in the Andes Mountains. I absolutely loved the mountains. But he had a cousin who lived in the rainforest. So we took this trip down into the rainforest, and it was a bus trip. And we went along these rickety little roads along the mountainside that really had room for one direction. And so the bus was going down, and some of the curves were so sharp that a wheel would actually have to hang off the mountain in order to make the full turn.
Good Lord!
So it was very precarious. And then all the way down, you see these plots of memorials with flowers and stuff where people had actually gone off the road. And so it was like a very interesting and challenging. I mean, it was a fine ride. It was probably just mentally challenging if you paid too much attention to the fact that there was this danger, because you would be riding along, and I just couldn't believe that the bus driver was nonchalant, because there were points where the water was coming down from the mountaintop and the road had actually been washed away. And so the bus was like traveling over this broken up, rocky portion of the road with water traveling through and a waterfall, and we're driving over it. And so the road was just amazingly precarious. So that was kind of an interesting ride, because it wasn't like the amusement park. There were no safety nets. If the thing went, you were gone.
Wow.
But, I mean, I didn't know this until I got there. So it was, you know, there wasn't an option. You couldn't do anything but, you know, stick with it. But we got down into this area safely. And it was interesting because it was more like, they were like homesteaders. So people who were essentially middle class, lower to middle class of the Ecuadorians, were going down into the rainforest and setting up farms and, trying to create a life down there. And at the same time, you saw all the loggers that were just, you know, every day trees would be coming down and they'd be trucking them out. But what happened is the lack of trees in the region left the ground very, very muddy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to wear these knee-length boots, because the ground was so soft that you would be sinking down into the earth up to your knees just to walk around. And this is because it still rained a lot. But it was a strange phenomena, because they say when they pick up the trees, the topsoil washes away and then there's nothing left to sustain agriculture underneath. So there was this strange mixture of sort of desert land where the soil had washed away, and then there was this muddy soil where the trees were recently removed that you'd have to walk around in these deep boots. And the settlers were primarily, I would say, well, they were middle class, so I guess they would be more mixed between indigenous and Spanish, and to some degree. But in the regions of the rainforest, there were people who were more specifically indigenous to those forests. And they were completely disenfranchised and had really no place to go and nothing to do. And they were living in these houses that were on huge stakes, so that in effect they were high off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly the purpose of those, the way their houses were built, because it was a rainforest with a lot of vegetation and water, so they built their houses high off the ground for that reason. But there was like this sense of hopelessness and a depression you would see in the indigenous people that were regional to the area of the rainforests in Ecuador. But at the same time, the people who were prospecting were also doing their best, according to what they knew, I suppose, to create a life in this new frontier. But the frontier, the land, did not really support the kind of lifestyle that they were trying to create. So the cattle weren't surviving. They were bringing cattle down. And it's really one of the things that they're saying is that a lot of the cattle that they've been putting into the rainforest have been a major part of building pollution, first of all. But a lot of the deforestation was, you know, supporting this industry. But it was a lovely family, and they did have cattle. But rather than raising cattle to slaughter, they decided to become cheese manufacturers. So they had this whole process where they would milk the cows, churn the cheese, put it into canisters, let it age, and seasonally they would take it to the market and sell it. So it was just a really interesting environment in terms of the social structures, because you could see the real disenfranchisement of the true Aboriginal class of people, indigenous people of the region. But at the same time, you saw this really pioneering spirit of the people who were moving into the rainforest to try to set up, their plantations or whatever it is they were doing, their farms. And then there was the level of the just the blatant exploitation of cutting down the trees, I guess, for sale and use and whatever wood is used for. So it was just such a strange environment that I found it very disconcerting, that I couldn't really connect with the forest on a deep level, at least in the rainforest, because actually the mountains also have a forest. But it was fascinating because it was this strange environment in which during the daytime the heat was blistering hot. And normally the trees would have been there to shade us from the heat, but in the absence of trees, it was really blistering hot. It was like creating a desert in the regions where the trees had been removed. But then it would rain, and when the rain came down, it was cold. The temperature would completely change, and you'd get a real chill. So it was just fascinating. And then there was a point at which the all of the farms and settlements came against the actual forest itself. And it was almost as if there was a wall of trees and vines, and everything was very interconnected, and you really couldn't walk into it very far. I would actually need a machete to walk through it, because it was really very, very dense. So, but I went into it a little bit, and as much into it as I could. But what's interesting also about the rainforest is how different and how lush the vegetation is. So, for instance, in the trees, the leaves, a single leaf was large enough, I would compare it to a blanket. It was a huge, huge, huge leaves.
Wow.
And the same was true of the insects. They were really, really big. And I saw butterflies that their wings were bigger than my hands. And I saw fruit, typical fruit, which you might think of as a mango, but it was bigger than a watermelon. It was just really, really interesting, the environment. It was very unusual. And so, everything was unusual and large and colorful. And so the forest was just this amazing, beautiful place. But the environment in the state that it was in, I found very disconcerting, and so I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would.
Well, it sounds a little bit like Alice in Wonderland.
It was
down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, it was a little bit strange, but I was really glad to be able to have seen it and to have been able to experience the various people who were involved in that process. And it was very depressing to see a massive amount at that point, and that was, at least 25 years ago when I went, it seems. And it was interesting because when you're flying, though, over, when you're flying in, flying out of Ecuador, you can see the forest as far as the eye can see, or at least at that time. And it makes me wonder how much of that at this stage, 25 years later, has been chopped down and how much is actually left standing.
So I wonder what other resources they have. The other resources exist in these areas the minerals or the precious metals.
And plant life, you know, all, you know, the plants of the Amazon forest are what a lot of pharmaceuticals are based on.
Yeah, yeah,
even though they're synthetic. Yeah. And so there's potentially the cure for everything there, if people were really preserving and studying the actual habitat and coming to understand the value of what's there. So it, to me, it was kind of an unfortunate turn of events for the earth and for the Aboriginal people of the region. And it's kind of what you were speaking of in that book.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The takers and Aboriginal people today are still, both North and South America, are fighting to preserve the land, the water, and the sacredness of their burial grounds and sites. And it seems every time the corporations are able to dominate. I'm not sure if that will be able to continue. I think things are changing. People are so much more aware at this time.
That is true. That is very true.
And people, so I think it's becoming a more challenging playing field for the corporate world to be able to get away with as much as they've gotten away with. And we can see how desperate the, you know, the capitalists are, and the way the election has been manipulated and the way the campaigns have been manipulated. But it seems the more obvious this manipulation becomes, the more people wake up to the truth of the sort of the underbelly of the world that we're living in. The folks at WBAI have heard and are aware of much of what's truly going on in the world, but we're living in a rare moment when a large part of the population is really beginning to look and question and to stand up for the planet and for transparency in the political and corporate world. We'll see how it goes. But from my perspective, things are getting better. Things are getting better at the same time as they're getting worse. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Have you heard anything about this episode with Hillary Clinton having a collapse at the 9/11 memorial ceremonies on Sunday?
I have not. I only heard that she had pneumonia. That was,
what was said. And but I've someone called it to my attention, and it happened, I guess, on the 11th. But I didn't hear about it till much later, because, well, first of all, I don't watch television. But then it may not have been on television. But I later started looking in at the on the internet, and it does look or appear that she has a serious medical issue. And, you know, she ended up being taken away in her security van, and now everyone is speculating over what's going on. So it'll be interesting to see how this develops. You know, I have compassion for anyone who is dealing with that level of illness in which you can't really stay in a state of equilibrium to be able to function within your role. But there have been other signs that she has some kind of epileptic or neurological disorder. Yeah. And I don't think that would disqualify someone from holding office.
Well, I would say, though, you have to have pretty good health to do a job like that.
I think that you do.
Yeah. Look at any president. Look at
age incredibly through the process.
You age very fast in that office. Look what happened to Reagan.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that Reagan was in the Oval Office for a long time after having been diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Right, right, right.
Which one would think could be a problem. And I'm looking at the situation with Hillary Clinton, but what to me is more damaging than the fact that she has a disorder is this desire to hide it, in some way pretend that it doesn't exist, and to find a way to get into the White House, keeping it under wraps. And then when I look at all the work that's been going on to counteract and disqualify Bernie Sanders, it makes me wonder about the forces behind the scene that are really in control. And I would think to the point that it's almost irrelevant who and what the presidential person is. Whoever is holding the seat is clearly not the person who's running the world or running the country.
Well, it's a complex issue, very complex. Mm-hmm. You know, the other day I heard Greg Palast talking on Coast to Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about stealing votes and how some people will not vote because, well, it's fixed anyway. He says, no, you know, you vote because you want to make them steal the votes.
You don't want to give it away.
Right.
Well, that's it. That's a perspective.
Yeah,
it makes sense to me. But also, you know, certainly in this election, one could still vote for a third party candidate if they choose to. There are other candidates in the mix. The independent candidate, Jill Stein. I believe there's also a conservative candidate if somebody wanted to make a decision other than the one at the top of the ticket, Donald Trump. So there are options that people can take that would make a difference if enough people took that option.
You know, it seems common sense has no bearing on a candidate's winning or not.
Well, it doesn't, no, because it's fixed. But I do think it's, I kind of agree with Palace. I think it's important to make a statement with your vote and exercise the vote. Even with a lot of what went on with Bernie Sanders, there were a lot of changes that were implemented that allegedly will take place in the next election. And there are still legal challenges in place. So things have been set in motion. And as well, he's attempted to initiate a movement that would continue the work that he started by electing a lot of people, having people run for local office, so that there can be a shift that may take some time to actually reach fruition. But I think that there's good in what everyone has attempted to do in our election. So I do think it's important to engage. I really do. So that's cool. I'm going to play a little bit of music. Let's see if we can find a little something. I think I'll go with Miriam Makeba.
Good choice.
West Wind.
West wind, blow ye gentle. From west wind, with your splendor, take my brother.
Lovely Miriam Makeba. So I had an interesting, as I was, before coming in, I was doing a little bit of writing. Actually, I've been writing all day. But it's not quite finished, but I thought I might share with our friends who are tuned in about, it's just a little piece that came to me. I have a tendency to communicate with my guides, my spiritual guides. And so sometimes they give me some information that's relevant to our times and what's going on with us. And so I thought I would share that with folks, and maybe it would be helpful. It was helpful for me. It might be helpful for others as well. Remember the feeling of being lost. This arises from the immersion in worldly thoughts and emotions. Resolution is not found in the debate of these issues. It only furthers the involvement of the mind, which does not have a capacity to know the truth of being. It is more appropriate to empty oneself of all thoughts, of weights and measures, and allow the self to move unencumbered by these considerations. And in that moment, I had an image of my cat, which came to my mind. And so it goes on, yes, like the cat who looks at the space before it and jumps gracefully onto the top of a table. The cat does not measure the distance or calculate the motion required. It allows the knowing of its body to assimilate the information needed and jumps confidently and gracefully to its goal. This is where you and humanity are now, looking at the distance before you. Rather than try to calculate that distance, allow your being to wait and assimilate. When the moment comes, you will jump. In the meantime, relax and enjoy all that is before you. Caress with your eyes, drink with your touch, smell with your toes, and expand all that you are. Delight in the expression of life as it flows through your being, and discover your being in the expressions that surround and engage you. Act and speak as inspired to do so. Let go of old habits and let go of old situations. Take refuge and comfort in the company of kindred souls, kindred friends, and kindred family. Your soul knows and will point you in the direction of least resistance. So resist not and follow that. Excuse me. So resist not and follow that which you hear in your heart. What is right and appropriate for another will never be right for you. And you can never know all that is sequestered in the root of another one's path. So it becomes necessary at this juncture of space and time to journey in the sovereignty of self. It is in this sovereignty that we become one in the magnificence of the all. So I found that very helpful because I had started to become really caught up in the issues of the day, you know, the politics, and I had started to be really contemplating the underlying isms of our life, you know, socialism, racism, discrimination, and unfairness, and people attacking each other and, you know, breeding hate into the environment in which we live. So that had started to begin to weigh heavy in my considerations. And I began to worry a little bit about the fate and the future and the moving forward of humanity. And so what I'm getting from this particular message is that is not to invest. I think we can pay attention to, we can know what's going on, but not to invest our thoughts and our emotions in the chaos. Easier said than done sometimes. And really move into our own vision, our own guidance, our own sovereignty, and continue to function in the strength of our own spirit. As you say, stand up etherically.
That's what Tom Wolfe says.
And it's from that place, if we can stay centered in that space, then we can be prepared to move in whatever direction we need to move, like the cat who can jump or move and really be very agile in the physical world, that we as human beings can be equally agile in being able to take care of our needs and move from one stage to the next if we don't allow ourselves to be distracted by the insanity that is encompassing the world at this moment. Because I believe, and what I witness is most of this insanity is being perpetrated by a very small number, very powerful but small number. And if we, as the human civilization, can be firm in who we truly are, then we can have a much more powerful position, self-empowered position, from which to move and evolve in the world. And what I see happening in those halls of power and politics, economics, that things are breaking down very quickly. So it's important, I believe, for each of us to be strong within ourselves and to align and move through as a sovereign being in alignment with the universal being of all, you know, the creator, the creation, the earth, the cosmos, the unified understanding as spoken of by many indigenous Aboriginal people of the earth. Well, we're all in some fashion indigenous and Aboriginal to the earth. It's just that we have been uprooted like those trees from the wisdom of our ancestors, from the wisdom of our mother cultures, wherever they may be. So I just feel this is a time to reconnect on all those levels. And the way to reconnect is to respect and honor that sovereignty of self, and so that we could move according to our own inspiration and not be swayed by the voices and the actions of the injustices of the world. And we can each make our way and reflect out that positive strength in support of each other and in bringing all of us together towards making the world better. And when things do collapse, and inevitably they will, then like the cat, we can just make the jump and create something new. That's what I got out of this particular guidance. And I found it to be very beautiful. And in a meditation, in alignment with this, I began to, as I went into my being, I began to see that empty cup. You know, there's a Taoist saying that talks about emptying your cup in order to be able to move forward, because we fill ourselves with so much information, so much strategy, so much worry, so much fear, that there isn't any room left to be who we truly are. So the idea is to empty that cup. And when we empty the cup, then we can descend or move into that emptiness within. And when we move into that emptiness, which seems like an empty space, is where we truly connect with the fullness of who we are, which is beyond words and beyond the physical reality. It's in that inner emptiness that we find the truth of all that is.
As Dr. Ali describes, is the language of silence.
Yes. So I just feel that we can, in many ways, come to live a very empowered, very supportive life, and we can share with each other in that support, in that building of the new, if we just can allow the old garbage to crash, to disintegrate under our feet, as long as we remain tall in the sovereignty of our divinity of self, we can survive it all. So that's, to me, the meaning of this particular little message that I shared with my guidance. We all have guides, higher selves, future selves, angel spirits, Netheru. We are so deeply connected to nature and to the animal world, to the mineral world. There's guidance, there's communication, there's healing on so many levels for humanity if we only turn our attention to it. So to me, that's an important message to share. We're going to have to move on. Coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. So I invite you to stay tuned for that. And also, I want to remind you that next week, the 21st of September, so I won't be able to speak to you before now and then, we are having our ongoing spiritual support group. It's at Studio yoga studio, Jnana Yoga, on Bond Street, right around the corner from Atlantic Avenue. And we'll be celebrating. We're going to have a ceremony for the energies of the time, which are very, very powerful. And we're going to be using these energies to empower ourselves, our sovereignty, healing, and moving forward in this new age. So if you'd like to join us and you need information, please send an email to heartofmindradio@gmail.com. That's heartofmindradio@gmail.com. We started out with Earth by Michelle Indiocello. We heard Miriam Makeba by West Wind. And now we're going to listen to Emmer Kenny, The Light of You.
Shine if you choose it to. There is a Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, our guest, as has been the case often near September 11th, is Richard Bowes. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. A few years ago, there was a documentary released called Not Quite Hollywood about the strange genesis and robust life of exploitation films, Australian-based exploitation films, the genre that gave us Mad Max, Road Warrior, stuff like that. Key among the filmmakers cited was Brian Trenchard-Smith, whose films capitalized on all the expected exploitation elements, baroque violence, gratuitous nudity, and a full-on embrace of a very Australian brand of car culture. But unless you were well-seasoned in sifting through the bins at your video rental shop, or managed to hit HBO on the right night, you were loath to come across his stuff. He didn't quite reach the stature that George Miller did. So that's... I'm Dan Persons, movie review the bins at your video rental shop, or managed to hit HBO on the right night. You were loath to come across his stuff. He didn't quite reach the stature that George Miller did. So that's changing now. There's going to be a Blu-ray release of Trenchard-Smith's Dead End Drive-In next week. I won't say this will change the face of the cinematic landscape, but it is genuine proof that the insanity of exploitation didn't stop at Mel Gibson's steering wheel. Brian Trenchard-Smith, in his audio commentary for the film, amusingly sums up Dead End Drive-In as a cross between Mad Max and The Exterminating Angel. I would throw in Rebel Without a Cause as well, given that it's a tale about a young man struggling to escape from the lot in life society has ordained for him. And by lot, I mean literally, since the film orchestrates its teen protagonist, Krabs, played by a not exactly age-accurate Ned Manning, to be imprisoned in a run-down drive-in theater that the post-apocalyptic government has commandeered as a permanent holding bin for the less useful portions of the youth population. Trenchard-Smith himself admits that the setup for this lunatic rewrite of The Great Escape, there's another reference for you, is at best awkward. The first 20 minutes are there basically to get in the obligatory car chase sequences. But once Krabs finds himself incarcerated in a world where restless youth is mollified by day with copious amounts of beer, drugs, and junk food, and by night with backseat sex and endless runs of violent action films, not surprisingly mostly Trenchard-Smith's own work, the film becomes a satirical observation of lower-class angst that hasn't particularly lost its relevancy, especially when the government begins siphoning in immigrant Asians and the drive-in's Anglo-Saxon population begins worrying about the distribution of resources. Dead End Drive-In, like the best of Ozploitation, mixes social commentary with inventive, low-budget filmmaking. And by the way, the cinematography by Paul Murphy is great. And it manages to make the War of the Classes funny, exciting, and just a little bit touching. If you're looking for something more nuanced, you can stay on the Pacific side of the world and check out The People Garden, which is having a very brief theatrical run, but is also available on demand. It's the tale of a woman, played by Dree Hemingway, who travels to a music video shoot set in a Japanese forest to break up with her rock star boyfriend, only to discover that the philanderer has fled into the woods, otherwise known as a legendary site for suicides. This isn't really a genre film, but director Nadia Litz, who also wrote the script, creates an atmosphere of low-key strangeness, taking her protagonist on a journey that leads her out of her self-involved indignation into a greater understanding of people and the world. The People Garden is more tone poem than full-on drama, but a mysterious and engaging one. I'm Dan Persons. Remember that now is the time when we must make a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
My name is Jim Freund. As I don't even know. Oh, yes, that's the DVD. Well, or rather the CD. Well, we're going to get to that, but not yet. Because before we listen to Richard Bowes on recording, We're going to listen to him live, and let's see if I can figure out what mic you're on.
We do it after the...
Yes, absolutely. But you're on the air now, so we should say good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
There you go. Okay. I don't know how I'll be fine once I get my headphones working. That says guest phones. So, for those who are unaware, which means that, well, you're among the great many who haven't heard my show through the years, Richard Bowes is a fairly regular guest on this program and sort of my go-to person when I know I need a quality show and there's no way that I'm going to create one on my own. I get Rick in here and he does that and for us. And this is a good thing because he is a writer of fabulous stature. I don't know exactly how many books you have. Is it about 10?
It's 10 books, yes.
Oh, good. Good six, guess, then.
6 novels and 4 short story collections. I've published 80 stories at this point, which...
Wow.
I never... Yes, that's what I say. It's completely unexpected.